Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. This one is entitled Hosea and Hope, and it is on the book of Hosea, specifically chapter 10. Now, before we jump into Hosea and Hope, I'd like to do a quick recap of where we have been before. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the history of Hosea and how there was this nation known as Israel in the 8th century BCE. And to the north was a mega military power known as Assyria, and to the east was another military power known as Aram. So Hosea is born into this nation that is not powerful, but is one of the weaker nations surrounded by military powerhouses. Additionally, within Hosea's own country of Israel, there was political turmoil and assassinations happening often, and there was a high turnover rate as to who the head of the state was. So Hosea is born in this context, and he writes his writing that eventually becomes Hosea in our Bibles, and the thesis of his writing is this: Israel must abandon their alliance with Assyria and return to the Lord. Hosea believed passionately that Israel's alliance with Assyria would lead to Israel's own destruction. And shortly after he finished writing and presumably died, in 722 BCE, Assyria invaded Israel from the north and destroyed Israel, and Israel was no more. So that was Hosea in history. Then last week, we talked about Hosea and women and how there's this misunderstanding of the story of Hosea. A lot of people believe that Hosea was told by God to marry a prostitute as a symbol for God's love for Israel. And God essentially said to Hosea, your marriage to Gomer, this prostitute, is an example of my love for Israel, because God, in Hosea's writing, says, I love Israel so much. Therefore, Hosea says, I love Gomer so much, just like God loves Israel. So that may sound like a nice story, but there's a real problem with this story. This story isn't in the Bible. And the story of Hosea and Gomer and God is quite different. And as we talked about last week, the story is much closer to this. Gomer was in love with another man. Hosea was jealous of this man. And Gomer essentially says to Hosea, please don't marry me. I love someone else. To which Hosea responds, how much can I buy you for? He then legally pays to own Gomer and then is furious when she does not love him back, even though he has purchased her. So what he then says is, how Gomer treats me is how Israel treats God. And last week we talked about the sexist, derogatory language toward women that permeates the writings of Hosea. And the reason we point this out is because Hosea is not interested in loving Gomer. Rather, Hosea is interested in owning, controlling, and power over Gomer. And the reason we study this is because when we can identify sexism within our own scripture, it helps us to identify sexism within our present realities. So that is where we have been within Hosea. And last week we ended with Hosea chapter 3, which brings us to Hosea chapter 4. Now we're going to go rather quickly through Hosea 4 through 9 so we can get to our passage of study in Hosea 10. And I'm just going to read one verse from each chapter of Hosea 4 to 9. Then once we get to Hosea 9, we'll summarize what each chapter is essentially trying to say. So let's begin with Hosea chapter 4. In verse 1, Hosea writes, hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty and no knowledge of God in the land. In chapter 5, verse 14, Hosea records God as saying this, for I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I myself will tear and go away. I will carry off and no one shall rescue. In Hosea 6, we look at verse 5, where Hosea records God saying, therefore I have hewn them by the prophets. I have killed them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as the light. In chapter 7, we'll look at verse 14, when Hosea records God saying, they do not cry to me from the heart, but they wail upon their beds. They gash themselves for grain and wine. They rebel against me. In chapter 8, let's look at verse 13, where Hosea writes, though Israel offers choice sacrifices, though they eat flesh, the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt. And then in chapter 9, we look at verse 7, where Hosea writes, "The days of punishment have come, the days of recompense have come. Israel cries, the prophet is a fool, the man of the spirit is mad. Because of your great iniquity, your hostility is great." So if we were to summarize Hosea chapter 4, I would summarize it with three words: God is angry. If we could summarize chapter 5, I'd summarize it with three words: God is angry. Hosea 6, God is angry. Hosea 7, God is angry. Hosea 8, God is angry. Hosea 9, God is angry. When you read Hosea for yourself, which is really important to not just take my word for it, but when you read it for yourself and you get to chapter 4 and you start to read through chapter after chapter, you cannot help but be overwhelmed by how angry God is. It's just one long rant of God and Hosea tag teaming as they criticize and reprimand and point the finger toward Israel and say, "You guys have brought this on by yourself. Are you afraid of Assyria? It's because of you." So with that premise in mind, we turn to Hosea 10, hoping for a reprieve from the anger. So let's read Hosea 10 together and see if the anger finally subsides. Hosea writes, "Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. For now they will say, 'We have no king, for we do not fear the Lord.' And a king, what could he do for us? They utter mere words with empty oaths that make covenants. So litigation springs up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Its people shall mourn for it, and its idolatrous priests shall wail over it, over its glory that has departed from it. The thing itself shall be carried to Assyria as tribute to the great king. Ephraim shall be put to shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. Samaria's king shall perish like a chip on the face of the waters. The high places of Aven, the sins of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars. They shall say to the mountains, 'Cover us,' and to the hills, 'Fall on us.' Since the days of Gibeah, you have sinned, O Israel. There they have continued. Shall not war overtake them in Gibeah? I will come against the wayward people to punish them, and nations shall be gathered against them when they are punished for their double iniquity. Ephraim was a trained heifer that loved to thresh, and I spared his fair neck. But I will make Ephraim break the ground. Judah must plow. Jacob must harrow for himself. Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap steadfast love. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. You have plowed wickedness. You have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies, because you have trusted in your power and in the multitude of your warriors. Therefore, the tumult of war shall rise against your people, and all your fortresses shall be destroyed, as Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off." My brothers and my sisters, if we could summarize Hosea chapter 10 in three words, the three words I would pick is this: God is angry. So from Hosea 4 to Hosea 10, God is an angry God. Now, this is a problem. This is a problem because Christians have this sense that we shouldn't be angry people. When you meet angry Christians, do you say to yourself, "You know, I just think they need a little bit more Jesus in their lives"? And this is a problem because we're told that God is all loving and that we should learn how to love like God loves. And then we read chapter after chapter after chapter in Hosea. And this God that we testify to the world is so incredibly loving just comes off as petty and judgmental and harsh and angry. And there's several problems with this. It's almost like there's this problem where we strive to be like God. And if that's what God is like, then I guess Christians should be angrier. But we all know that just simply isn't true. Not only that, but when you think about how God created this universe, God created this universe with human free will. But when we read these passages about how God is angry when humans actually exercise this free will, the question becomes, well, does God really support free will? Or does God only support free will so long as humans choose as God would have them choose? Because that actually isn't free will. So there are all sorts of problems that rise to the surface when God is angry for 7 chapters in a row. And it's not just Christians who recognize that this is a problem, but there are people outside of the Christian tradition who hear about angry Christians and say, I'm not sure you guys are supposed to be that. And when they hear about God being angry, they say, I thought God was all about love. Perhaps nobody illustrates this understanding of what Christians should be better than the animated series South Park. Now, South Park is a TV show that is raunchy and crude and often hilarious all at the same time, produced and put together by people who don't really identify as Christians. Yet, they talk about Christianity frequently on their show and how Christianity relates to the rest of the world. One episode in particular follows one of the main characters, a boy named Eric Cartman, who decides to start a Christian rock band to sell as many records as possible. And the way that this kid, who does not identify as Christian on the show, sells these Christian records is he takes popular songs and wherever the popular song says baby, he crosses it out and just writes Jesus. And wouldn't you know it, Cartman's band becomes a huge hit. His band is called Faith Plus One, and it's made up of 3 kids. He's the lead singer, but none of them say or identify as Christian. So because they're so popular, they end up at all these Christian music festivals, and they start to meet other Christian bands. And one of the bands they meet is a band named Sanctified. Now, Sanctified has all kinds of tattoos and facial hair and mohawks, and they look like a punk band should look, right? And when Eric Cartman and Faith Plus One meet Sanctified, Sanctified says to them, "We're the band Sanctified. We play metal and punk, but with lyrics that inspire faith in Christ." And then another band member says, "Yeah, we prove that Christian music can be tough and hardcore." To which Cartman responds, "Yeah, you guys are real hardcore." Now, the drummer picks up on Cartman's sarcasm and gets in his face and says, "You bet your gosh darn rear end we're hardcore." And the reason this scene is funny is because the people of South Park, the people who create South Park, even though they don't identify as Christian, understand that Christians should not be angry, hardcore people, right? This is the reason that nobody listens to the band Rage Against the Machine and thinks, "Oh, there's a Christian band." Now, as you can imagine, Rage Against the Machine is angry music, hence the title Rage Against the Machine. And if you've never heard them, I'd like to play a song for you, a snippet of a song for you called Killing in the Name Of. This is Rage Against the Machine.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses.
So people hear this band, Rage Against the Machine, and they immediately assume they aren't Christian because they sound angry, because Christians shouldn't be angry. And when we look closely at the words, we realize they're not singing about things that fit within the genre of Christian music. In fact, the lyric that they use over and over again in the verse in this song is, "Some of those who work forces are the same that burn crosses." And Rage Against the Machine's Killing in the Name Of is a song about white supremacists being employed as police officers and the corruption within the police force when a white supremacist is allowed to enforce the law. These are things that Christians shouldn't sing about, right? Although it raises an interesting question. How should Christians react when white supremacists are employed as police officers? Should we be okay with it? Should we accept it? Should we fight against it? How are Christians supposed to react when white supremacists are employed as police officers? Because I'll tell you how most Christians I know react. They react by rejecting the notion that this is possible. But the truth is, it is possible. In October of 2016, PBS ran an article in which they were looking at an event that happened 10 years ago. The title of the article was "The FBI Warned of White Supremacists in Law Enforcement 10 Years Ago. Has Anything Changed?" Now, the authoress of this article is a woman named Kenya Downs, and she writes these words in this article. In a 2006 bulletin, the FBI detailed the threat of white nationalists and skinheads infiltrating police in order to disrupt investigations against fellow members and recruit white supremacists. The bulletin was released during a period of scandal for many law enforcement agencies throughout the country, including a neo-Nazi gang formed by members of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department who harassed Black and Latino communities. And so when Christians reject the notion that there are any white supremacists working within the police force, they are denying what the FBI was onto in 2006, which is they had intel and intelligence and beliefs and evidence that white supremacists were being employed by law enforcement. And in this FBI bulletin in 2006, they were citing Los Angeles as the genesis of a case where white supremacists were proven to be in law enforcement. And if you look this article up online, you can click on the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and it links you to an article written by a man named Hector Tobar, written in October of 1991, where he talks about a federal judge's ruling on the Los Angeles Sheriff Department that just happened. Hector Tobar writes this: "A federal judge has concluded that many Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies at the Linwood Station routinely violate civil rights, motivated by racial hostility, and use terrorist-type tactics with the knowledge of their superiors. In unusually strong language, Judge Hatter found that a neo-Nazi white supremacist gang of deputies, the Vikings, exists at the Linwood Station with the knowledge of department officials." And in 1991, a federal judge found the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department guilty of housing a gang of white supremacists within their own law enforcement, and the authorities above them knew about it and did nothing to stop it. 11 days after this article was published, a band known as Rage Against the Machine played their first show in Cal State Northridge. And the way that Rage Against the Machine begins so many of their shows is they say, "We are Rage Against the Machine and we're from Los Angeles, California." And so this band was formed in the midst of this horrendous scandal within the Los Angeles Police Department. And so about a year later, they release a record, and they've written and recorded and produced a song called "Killing in the Name of," and the verse of that song says this: "Some of those that work forces are the same that bar crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that bar crosses." And so if you were to ask Rage Against the Machine, why do you write angry music? Why did you call your band Rage Against the Machine? Why don't you write about happier things? I guarantee you the lead singer, Zach, would tell you a wide variety of things to be angry about. And one of those things he would say is systemic brutality of law enforcement that is racially motivated to ethnic minorities. And the reason they write songs that sound angry is because Rage Against the Machine feels that systemic racism against Blacks and Latinos in the LAPD is something worth getting angry about. And as Christians, I have a question to ask for people within our faith tradition. Is systemic racism against Blacks and Latinos in the LAPD something worth getting angry about? Of course it is. Yes, this is a horrendous evil. This is sin incarnate. This is an injustice, and it is absolutely worth getting angry about when white law officials see white supremacy and see all of this racism happening and doing nothing to stop it. And there is this sense that Christians shouldn't be angry about stuff like this. Instead, we should just pray about it and pray, "Dear Lord Jesus, come back soon and right all of the wrongs." But I have a question I'd like to ask you. If Jesus walked among us and lived in Southern California instead of the Middle East, and was born and raised and was of age in 1991, when this story comes down about a federal judge finding white supremacy within the LAPD, and Jesus is living in LA. How do you believe Jesus would react and act toward this sin? Do you think that Jesus would say, well, you know, we should love the sinner and hate the sin? Do you think that Jesus would say, well, you know, we just need to accept that people are imperfect? Do you believe that Jesus would say, oh, well, I'm sure their hearts were in the right place, like we can't hold them too accountable? I don't believe that Jesus would have done that. I believe that Jesus would have been angry. And there are people who believe that Jesus was never angry when he walked on this earth. That is simply not true when you read the Gospels. Because what you find is that Jesus is never critical of who society has deemed as sinners, whether the religious institution has called them a sinner or the state has called them a sinner. Jesus, throughout the Gospels, refuses to criticize those the state and the religion have criticized. But Jesus does criticize others. And Jesus does get angry with others. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus consistently gets angry and judges those who abuse power. And this story about the Linwood Police Department in 1991 is the worst kind of abuse of power. And how you would expect Jesus to react to the sin of the Linwood Police Department is exactly what you believe is actually the judgment of God. Now, there is a lot of negative connotation when we bring up the judgment of God. And the reason for this is that churches throughout religious history have exploited the individual's sense of shame. That's not what we're talking about. It is not sinful to be human. What Jesus gets angry with over and over again is the abuse of power. And he judges it and declares it wrong and shines a spotlight on it and says, "We can't have this anymore." That is what the judgment of God does. So if Jesus was living in 1991 in Los Angeles and heard about this story, I believe that Jesus would have stood up and said, what the Linwood Police Department has done is one of the worst evils on the planet today. And you can imagine Jesus' friends in 1991 saying, Jesus, calm down. This isn't really popular. Do you really believe that this is the right thing to do, to speak out against the police department? Because they're the police department. We shouldn't talk about how they're corrupt. And I believe Jesus would have continued to speak out against it. And you may ask me how I know. And it's because I've read the story of Jesus' crucifixion and how he continued to speak out against the abuse of power, both within religion and within the empire of Rome. And that consistent speaking out led to his death. My brothers and my sisters, the story of Jesus and the sinful abuse of power teaches us today that there are some things that are worth getting angry about. Now, notice that I said some things and not all things, because for that, I would like to tell you a story. This story involves my brother-in-law, Erwin, and my brother-in-law, Erwin, is a great brother-in-law, but he is also a laid-back brother-in-law. And so he was going to Starbucks, and he went through a Starbucks drive-thru, and this was a few months ago, and he gets the drive-thru, and it's 11:30 in the morning. He rolls down his window, and he places his order. He says, "Hi, I'd like a peppermint mocha, please." There is a bit of a pause on the other end from the barista, and the barista responded by saying this, "Sir, we're out of peppermint mocha." Now, my brother-in-law said, "That's fine. I'll have a vanilla latte." He then drove around to pick up his drink, and he went to pay for it. And the barista opened the window, and she said, no, sir, we don't need your payment." And he said, "What?" And she said, "Your vanilla latte is on the house." And he was surprised. He said, "That's very kind. Can I ask why?" And she said, "I've been working since 6 this morning. people have been ordering the peppermint mocha all day. And then she looked right at my brother-in-law and said this. She said, "You're the first person all day who hasn't yelled at me for us being out of peppermint mocha." So please enjoy this vanilla latte. Now, why do I bring this story up? It's because there are also some things that are not worth getting angry about, right? And Starbucks being out of peppermint mocha is not worth you and I yelling at the barista. There is a huge, astronomical, light years worth of divide between being out of peppermint mocha and systemic racism, which leads to racially motivated police brutality in the LAPD, right? A huge divide. And there are some things that are worth getting angry about, and there are some things that are not worth getting angry about. So when we return to Hosea, and we read from chapter 4 to chapter 10 about how God is angry, God is angry, God is angry, and we say, this is a problem, God shouldn't be angry because Christians shouldn't be angry, I don't want to read this passage. We should get rid of that idea that it is a problem. Because it's not a problem. As long as God isn't angry over petty, insignificant things, but instead God is angry about the things that matter. So rather than pointing at Hosea 4 to 10 and saying, well, this is a problem, God is angry, what do we do with this? A much better question to ask is, what is God angry about? Because when God gets angry, it's got to be about something that matters. I don't think Hosea would write about God being angry that Starbucks is out of peppermint mocha. I do believe that Hosea would write about God being angry about systemic racism. So what is God angry about? Well, this, my brothers and sisters, is why we read chapter 10. Because in chapter 10, Hosea writes three reasons that God is angry. Now, these are just three reasons in one chapter out of the seven chapters that we read. But these three reasons provide the anger, the reason for the anger in chapter 10. And in verses 5 to 8, Hosea cites Samaria as a reason that God is angry. Now, Samaria is the capital of Israel. And it is here at Samaria that a golden calf resides in the capital. And people point to that and they say, that is our God. Now, a misreading of the text is to believe that the people of Israel rejected God and instead replaced God with the calf. But that's not really what's going on. What they have done is they have reduced God down to an inanimate, tangible object. And there is this fear among the people of Israel that if Assyria comes in and destroys them, they will take their golden calf and lose God. Not only that, but that calf is the symbol of the secession of Israel from Judah. And that statue is a symbol and a reason behind why this unified nation of Israel split into two, Israel and Judah, and there were civil wars and bloodshed and fighting and violence. So Hosea points to Samaria and says, what happens at Samaria is worth getting angry about. We still have not reconciled the sins of what happened at Samaria, and we are still suffering from the consequences of this. What happened at Samaria is wrong, and we need to do something about it. Before we can catch our breath, Hosea moves on to the next place, Gibeah, which he writes about in verses 9 and 10. And Gibeah is a gruesome story. Gibeah's story is found in Judges 19 and 20, and I would tell you it is the most horrifying rated R story in all of the Bible. I will give you the short and condensed version. Basically, a man, we'll call him Levi, was traveling with his concubine. They were traveling and the sun went down, so they decided to stay at a town called Gibeah. When they arrived, a very kind elderly gentleman took them in. And so they stayed at this elderly gentleman's house. But late at night, a mob came to the elderly gentleman's home and banged on the door and demanded the elderly gentleman to throw Levi out to the people so that they could rape him. In response to this threat of sexual assault, the elder, responds by saying, "You can instead have my daughter who is a virgin and this man's concubine if you will leave the man alone." The mob says, "We don't want the women. We want to rape the man." So in response, the elder grabs Levi's concubine and throws her outside the mob. The mob then decides to rape her and then kill her. Now Levi goes to bed. He wakes up the next morning, opens the door, and finds the carcass of his concubine laying on the doorstep. He then decides to butcher her. He slices her into several pieces and mails it to the 11 other tribes of Israel outside of Gibeah. The 11 other tribes get the pieces of this mutilated carcass, and they respond with war, and they declare war on the city of Gibeah and the larger tribe of Benjamin. And it is the first civil war within Israel's history. Hosea points to this gruesome story filled with sexism, rape, murder, violence, vengeance, all sorts of things. And he says, "We have never apologized and reconciled and made things right from this horrendous evil. And because of that, we are still suffering today. We are still fighting with each other, and we can't figure it out because we still have not confronted the evil that happened at Gibeah. God is angry about what happened at Gibeah, and we must do something to make that right, even though it happened a very long time ago." Which brings us to the third story that Hosea cites. In verses 13 and 14, he references a story at Beth Arbel. Now, this one's a little muddier, but historians believe that this is the place where Jehu made an alliance with the Assyrian king Salmanasar III. And this alliance, according to Hosea, is wrong. It's wrong because God's intent, Hosea says, was for us to never be a military nation who allied and fought against other nations. We were called as a nation to bless other nations, to love them, to accept them, to get along with other nations rather than form alliances and military might and conquer other nations. And so he points to this loss of identity by saying, "We forgot who God created us to be as outlined in Genesis 12. And because we've forgotten our identity, God is angry with us." And so he points to Samaria, Gibeah, and Beth Arbel. And he says, all of these injustices God looks at and says, "No, what happened here was wrong." In other words, Hosea believes that God confronts the injustices of Samaria, Gibeah, Beth Arbel, and says, "Never again." Now, you may have listened to these stories and you may have heard them with indifference. And the reason you are indifferent toward these stories is because they are not your history or my history. And while some stories may sound bad, imagine if this was part of the history of your nation. If Hosea was writing to us in Southern California today, I do not believe that he would have cited these three stories and said, "Hey, everyone in America, remember what happened at Gibeah." I don't think it would have happened. But I think he would have pointed to the sins of America and said, "Never forget what happened there, because God looks back at those and says, we have to make things right." I can imagine that if Hosea was writing to us today, he would say, "God is angry with America for what they did in the 19th century to the indigenous people of this country and of this land." He would point specifically to the Trail of Tears. When the executive branch of the government overruled the Supreme Court, who was on the side of the indigenous population, and marched the Native Americans out of their homes that they'd been at long before white people were there, and forced them to traverse hundreds and a thousand miles on something that would later be known as the Trail of Tears, because thousands of Native Americans crossed this land and 20% of them passed away because the conditions were so harsh. Why? Because the president of the United States, Andrew Jackson, wanted to prove a point that he was in charge over the Supreme Court. And after writing about the Trail of Tears, I can imagine Hosea writing about Selma, Alabama. Just over 50 years ago, it was nearly impossible to be a person of color and register to vote in the state of Alabama. even though that right was guaranteed by the 15th Amendment. And so to protest and to raise national awareness that people in Alabama were not being allowed to vote, that Americans in Alabama were not allowed to vote simply because of the color of their skin, they decided to organize a march from Selma, Alabama, 50 miles down the road to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama. Well, just outside of Selma, they cross the bridge and they get to the other side of the bridge and they are met by police officers who demand that they disperse. And this crowd that is on the march says, "Why should we disperse?" And the police officers say, "Disperse now or we will use force to deal with you." And when the crowd refused to disperse, the police officers used tear gas and horses and billy clubs and beat them simply because they were marching peacefully for justice. I can also imagine that Hosea would write about Manzanar. Shortly after the United States entered World War II, there was an executive order that required all Americans of Japanese descent to report to internment camps because the American government was worried that they were actually spies. And so 120,000 American citizens were incarcerated without a trial simply because of their heritage. And they lived in concentration camps up and down the West Coast and as far east as Colorado. And one of these camps was a place called Manzanar, and it's on the road from here to Mammoth Lakes, California. And here at Manzanar, there was a woman who was just a child when she was incarcerated without a trial. And she wrote a book called Farewell to Manzanar. And in that book, she said, it's telling that there are Japanese internment camps on the West Coast, while on the East Coast, there is no such thing as German internment camps for people of German heritage. And this racially motivated incarceration is one of the worst sins in American history. And I can imagine that if Hosea was writing to us in Southern California today, he would point to the Trail of Tears and to Selma and to Manzanar and say, God is angry with those sins and God confronts those injustices and says, never again. And so in Rage Against the Machine, 2,700, 2,800 years after the life of Hosea, sees that a terrible injustice happen within the LAPD, and they write, some of those who work forces are the same that burn crosses, and they're pointing at it and saying, I am angry that people didn't do something about white supremacy within the police department. They are confronting it and saying, never again, this actually happens, and we cannot allow it to go on. And it's important for us to recognize that Rage Against the Machine stands in solidarity with the work that Hosea was doing 2,800 years ago. What Hosea did is exactly what they did in 1991 and 1992. Because Hosea would have pointed at that police department and said, never again. God is angry about the fact that this was allowed to happen and so many other people looked the other way. We must repent, have a change of heart, and vow to never allow white supremacists to hold the position of police officer ever again. Hosea would say that is the judgment of God. And so while we may have a negative connotation with the words the judgment of God, what Hosea writes about is the fact that the judgment of God confronts the injustices of the world today. If Jesus walked among us, what would Jesus judge, point to, call out, and say, this can never happen again? That is the judgment of God. Now, at this time, and for the rest of this podcast, I'd like to make this really personal and talk about how this idea impacts you and me today. So we discussed Hosea 4 through 10, which is filled with the anger of God. But it's important for you to read these passages for yourself. Because in the midst of these rants, there are these seeds that are strewn throughout that are quite a different tone. And these seeds look like an anomaly unless you look at the whole passage and you say, oh, there's some sort of consistent theme running through this entire passage. Now, the way it shows up in chapter 10 is found in verse 12, when Hosea writes, sow for yourselves righteousness, reap steadfast love, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. Now, the Hebrew word for righteousness is the Hebrew word tzedakah. So when we read righteousness within the Hebrew text, it's often from the word tzedakah. Now, tzedakah is interesting because a lot of us understand righteousness as kind of a personal piety. The idea that I go to church often, that I pay tithe regularly, that I know a lot of Bible verses. A lot of people understand righteousness as personal piety, but that's not what tzedakah is. Because while we translate tzedakah as righteousness, we also translate tzedakah as justice. So the fact that justice and righteousness are translated from the same word shows that they are related. And the pursuit of that justice is also known as righteousness. And if you've been with us at Paradox before, the best definition we can give at righteousness is a life that is worth living, a life that has value and meaning and purpose. And the way that Hosea frames this is when somebody chases after justice and longs for things to be right and made right and reconciled, then they are living a life that is worth living. So here, Hosea writes, sow for yourselves righteousness, sow for yourselves tzedakah, reap steadfast love, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. So here's Hosea in Israel, and Assyria is knocking on the doorstep. And the thing that he decides to tell the people of Israel is not, hey, go get more weapons because Assyria is almost here. Instead, he looks at them and he says, sow for yourselves tzedakah. Trust justice. Continue to search for what is right. And what Hosea is essentially saying is he's saying, like, look, I know it looks grim, but I believe that we can change our fate. Our story isn't done. There is still hope for us. Now, while it's one thing for us to read these words in Southern California in 2018, it's a whole nother thing to read these words in Israel. 2,800 years ago with a threatening foreign power breathing down your neck. You can imagine people responding saying, like, righteousness, justice, I gotta hoard weapons so I can survive. I think our story's done, Hosea. I'm preparing for the end. And you can imagine a lot of people heard these words about Hosea's hope, and they responded to this hope with despair. And when we think about despair and hope, I'd like to ask you, who are we called to be? People of hope or people of despair? Because people of despair are people who trust in the cruelty of the universe. They believe it's a dog-eat-dog world. That you've got to take everything that you can because the amount of resources on this earth are scarce. They hoard money. They hoard possessions. They are first and foremost concerned with their own personal safety and own well-being. Why? Because they believe the universe is a cruel, lonely place. And it's every man and every woman for themselves. Conversely, what does it mean to be a person of hope? Because I believe that a person of hope trusts in the goodness of the universe. And when Hosea is imploring the people of Israel to put their weapons down and sow for themselves righteousness, it is a message and a beacon of hope in trusting in the goodness of the universe and the goodness of God. If we cease to be people of war, maybe then we can turn things around, because this world, the way we get ahead, is not by killing one another, but by seeking tzedakah. Now, here's what's interesting. I know a lot of Christians who instantly point to hope and they say, well, we're called to be people of hope. And one of two things happens. The first is they assume that because we are people of hope that we should not be angry. And so this is why we get radio stations who profess to be Christian and they refuse to play any kind of negative song whatsoever. And it puts us back in that category of Christians shouldn't be angry. The fact is we have tried our best to show that Christians should be angry about some things. Secondly, I know Christians who profess to be people of hope, but are actually people of despair. I know Christians who have pointed at the horrendous evil that happened in Parkland, Florida with this school shooting and have shrugged their shoulders and said, well, nothing can be done. I mean, you know, we have this debate all the time. We have this debate all the time and nothing ever changes. That, my brothers and sisters, is despair. That is to trust the cruelty of the universe over the goodness. I know other Christians who say they're people of hope. They say Jesus is coming back soon and he's going to burn this world. So everything here doesn't matter. So just keep what you can for yourself and just hang on and don't talk to people who are outside the Christian tradition because they might water down your faith. That is not a message of hope. That is not trusting in the goodness of the universe. That is a message of despair, and it speaks to the cruelty of the universe. And so we're called to be people of hope, but not people who are naive in our hope or choose to be ignorant in our hope. The author Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a book to his son, trying to explain to his son the way the world works and what it's like to be a black man in America. And the name of the book is called Between the World and Me. And in it, he writes these words, "Son, I would not have you descend into your own dream. I would have you be a conscious citizen of this terrible and beautiful world." I love Coates' language in that sentence. To be a conscious citizen of this terrible and beautiful world. We are called to be conscious citizens in this terrible, beautiful world, who are also people of hope. People who trust in the goodness of the universe, who believe that it is worthwhile to sow tzedakah. When we trust in the goodness of the universe, we are more likely to be generous because we recognize all that has been given to us. When we trust in the goodness of the universe, we are more likely to give grace away because we recognize that grace has been given to us. When we trust in the goodness of the universe, we are going to be more accepting of others because we recognize the universe has accepted us. When we trust in the goodness of the universe, we are more likely to be loving because we recognize that while we cry and we grieve and we lament, love is the real story and it is the engine of this universe. My brothers, my sisters, may you and I choose this week and in the weeks beyond to be people of hope, to be conscious citizens of this beautiful and terrible world, and to look at the evils of this world and say, never again. May you see and embrace the inspiration in all.